Well, good evening and welcome. I'm very pleased to welcome you to Colette House. My name's Martin Redfern. I'm a trustee of the Study Society who owns this house and also for the moment a director of the Scientific and Medical Network, which has co-sponsored this event. Although I have to say most of the work has been done by the Contemplative Consciousness Network with Elizabeth West, and we are hugely grateful, Elizabeth, for both for you doing all the work and organising this and for choosing Colette House to come here. So we're very pleased to have you all here. And you would also, everyone would be very welcome to take part in other activities by all three organisations for which there's literature out in the hall and plenty of people around to tell you about it. But you don't want to hear about this because you've come to hear two remarkable gentlemen. It's been a great pleasure to meet both Alan Wallace and Bernard Carr, and certainly Bernard and I have gone back for quite a while because he was chairman of the Scientific and Medical Network for many years and we've worked closely together. And I'm pleased to say, Alan, this isn't your first visit to Colette, so we have met before as well. I'm sure neither of them need much introduction from me, but suffice it to say, I think we're in for a really interesting evening because Alan's background, both in physics and Tibetan Buddhism, is very deep indeed. Bernard's depth of understanding of physics and his personal quest for the nature of consciousness and the mysteries of time and space and so on, the paths are very close, though I don't think you've actually met before, have you? So I think we're in for a very interesting dialogue. The structure of the evening is that Bernard is going to give a presentation first, followed by Alan. Then the two of them will dialogue for a bit, and then we can throw the floor open for some questions into that dialogue. So without any further ado, let us welcome, first of all, Bernard Carr.
Thank you, Martin. First of all, it's very exciting to be here because the theme of tonight's discussion is really, well, three of my most interesting, the topics I'm most interested in, space, time, and consciousness. And also, of course, it's going to give me an opportunity to interact with Alan. I have to say, I'd never met Alan before, but I read his books, and I was really struck by the similarity in some of our ideas, even though we come from different directions, myself from physics and Alan from Buddhism, but we both got an interest in the other side. So I'm really looking forward to this evening's dialogue. I've started off with just a Buddhistic image, which to me relates to a space-time diagram, which will become clear maybe later why. But I thought I would start off by actually giving a very personal perspective as to how I've got interested in these topics. And actually, it really all goes back to when I was about 15, when I was at school. And I read three books, all in a period of about 1 week. And those three books really set the direction of my life. The first book was on relativity theory. It was Bertrand Russell's ABC of Relativity. And that got me fascinated in the ideas of space and time. The second book I read was a book some of you may have heard of by J.W. Dunn called An Experiment with Time, in which he wrote about his precognitive dreams and the theory of his consciousness, which came out of that. And that got me interested in what's sometimes called psychic phenomena. But the third book was a book on Buddhism. It was, in fact, Lobsang Rampa's The Third Eye. Now, any Buddhist scholars here will know that that is not really a very reputable book from an academic point of view. Nevertheless, it got me fascinated in the subject. And so those three books, which I read in a very short period, really fired up in me these three interests in science, psychical research, and Buddhism, or more generally, I guess, spirituality. And when I went to Cambridge, I therefore immediately joined the Cambridge University Astronomical Society, the Cambridge University Society for Psychical Research, and the Cambridge Buddhist Society. And I became an astronomer, so that became my professional field. I took up meditation, so in some sense that was my, I suppose, the start of my spiritual path. I've been a devout Buddhist. I'm now, I guess, more interested in spirituality, but I've always maintained my interest in Buddhism. And so really, throughout my life, these three activities have, to a greater or lesser extent, I suppose, motivated my path. And I put psychical research there in the middle for a particular reason, because to me, psychical research actually provides a bridge, it provides a link between science and spirituality, for the reasons which I will explain. So there is the bridge between science and spirituality, which I suppose is in some sense the underlying theme which interests me. How do you link these two areas? And as I said, to me, psychical research, which is sometimes called psi, argues that there is a link. And I suppose now I should say the scientific and medical network is also part of that bridge, because the scientific and medical network also tries to link science and spirituality and psychical research. But I have to say at the outset that being on a bridge is not a very comfortable position. The strain of the bridge, you tend to be criticized. If you're interested in psychical research, you tend to be criticized by the scientists for being too spiritual or too mystical, and by the mystics for being too scientific. So it's not a comfortable position to be in, but to my mind, it's a necessary position to be in if you want to forge this link. Now, this is my favorite picture, and many of you have heard me talk about this before, so I'm going to go through this quite quickly. But I am a physicist, and so I want to start off by describing what to me is a triumph of physics. And this is called the Ouroboros. It's the snake which swallows its own tail. I don't have a pointer, but if you look around the body of the snake, you have the various object structures which exist in the universe. So at the bottom, you have human beings. As you go to the right, you have progressively larger objects, mountains, planets, stars, solar systems, galaxies, the whole universe. As you go to the left, you have progressively smaller objects like ants, amoebas, DNA, atoms, nuclei. And so, if you like, the body of the snake is a sort of ruler. And as you go from the top to the bottom, you go through 60 decades of scale. So every minute corresponds to a factor of 10 in scale. And what I like about this diagram is it also it represents, in some sense, the history of our understanding, increased understanding of the physical universe. So let me just take you on a little one-minute tour of the history of physics. Because the history of physics, in a way, is looking to ever larger and ever smaller scales. And so we start off on our outward journey looking to larger and larger things. We started off, of course, with the geocentric view. But then we realized with the Copernicus that actually the sun is the center of the universe, so we had the heliocentric view. And then by the turn of the 20th century, we realized that actually the galaxy itself, the sun, we realized that the sun is just one of billions of stars in the galaxy, so we had the galactocentric view, in which the universe was the galaxy. Then we realized that actually our galaxy is one of billions of galaxies, and that's the cosmocentric view. And now we even realize that our universe may just be one of many, many universes. So as we've looked out to bigger and bigger scales, we've discovered all these, well, we've been progressively dethroned from the center of the universe. As we go on the scale, as we go on the inward journey, we've discovered just as many remarkable things. We've discovered, of course, that solid objects are not solid, but made of atoms, which are mainly empty space. We know that in the middle of the atoms and nuclei, the atom itself is mainly empty space. The nuclei is in the middle, and there we have the nuclear forces unleashed in nuclear explosions. And then we know the nuclei themselves are made up of quarks and things, and that's the standard model, which was gloriously vindicated not so long ago with the discovery of the Higgs boson. And now, of course, we're looking for other features of particle physics, supersymmetry, and the final theory of the universe, the final theory of physics is called M-theory, and M-theory is like a theory of the vacuum. This is the smallest scale you can go to. So this diagram basically takes you from the very smallest scales you can conceive of, way down from 10 to the minus 33 centimetres, to the largest scale you can conceive of, the observable universe, 10 to the 27 centimetres. So it's 60 decades of scale. And so what I love about that picture is that it reveals, it shows how science has revealed the structure of the universe from the very largest domain to the microscopic world, to the very smallest domains of the microscopic world, to the very large domains of the macroscopic world. And that really is a triumph. And this is, remember, we're talking about space, time, and consciousness. So what this diagram shows is how our awareness of space has developed through physics, through science. Of course, why does the snake swallow its own tail? Well, that's because the universe began with a big bang. And the point is, you know, in astronomy, when you look at something at great distance, you're looking in the past. So if you're looking at something a million light years away, you're looking as it was a million years in the past. Well, the universe began in a state of great compression 14 billion years ago. So when you look to the greatest distances, you're actually looking back in time when the universe was very young. So ironically, when you get to the largest, when you get to 14 billion light years, the universe was basically of zero size. So that's why the very large meets the very small. And it starts with the Big Bang, and the idea of the Big Bang, therefore, the universe is expanding, and it started 14 billion years ago in a state of great compression. And that's, of course, what cosmologists study, what happens in the history of the Big Bang. And so what's really interesting about the Big Bang, as I said, that's where the microscopic and the macroscopic domains meet, where the head meets the tail. And so that represents the origin of the universe. But it also represents, in some sense, the fundamental idea of physics, where microphysics and macrophysics meet. It's also that initial state was in some sense a vacuum. The universe began in a vacuum. And the vacuum is the key to understanding the link between the very large and the very small. Now, when you're talking about the history of the universe, you're talking about the time. So we've got the space and the time. So where does the consciousness come in? Well, of course, if you think about it, the history of physics, as I've described it, is really a history of the expansion of our consciousness to ever larger and smaller scales. And so, on the right here, I've just... the little arcs illustrate what awareness we had of what different scales at different centuries, if you like. So obviously, primitive early man only had awareness of a small range of scales, the inner arc. By the time we got to the 16th century, we got to look at the edge of the solar system and to the size of amoebas and things. By the time we got to the 20th century, we basically got to the edge of the universe and we got to the scale of the elementary particles. So to me, the other aspect of the Ouroboros, it not only represents our knowledge of physics, it represents the blossoming of our consciousness. And yet, what is strange about this is that there is something missing from this picture. Physics has been triumphant in explaining the physical world, but there's something which is obviously missing. And what is missing? It's our own mind. It's our consciousness. And yet, that's what most of our, half of our experience of the world is not of the physical. It's of these other domains of existence. And that's missing. So how come physicists think they're on the verge of a theory of everything when they don't actually explain actually the most fundamental aspects of our experience? Here's a quote from David Lindley. I hope you can read it. Actually, I can't read it myself. We humans are just crumbs of organic matter clinging to the surface of one tiny rock. Cosmically, we are no more significant than mold on a shower curtain. David Lindley. David Lindley was one of my students. In fact, I was his PhD examiner. So you see, the price we pay for this great triumph is that we have become completely insignificant. We're obviously completely insignificant in terms of scale, but we're also completely insignificant in terms of our role in the universe. Here's the theory of everything. I expect a lot of you saw this. This was the film about Stephen Hawking and his wife, Jane, first wife, Jane. I was Stephen's PhD student. Stephen, of course, is famous because he's looking for the theory of everything. But those of you who've seen the film will know, actually, that the theory of everything is really about his relationship with his wife. And so the irony is, I mean, there's very little discussion about the theory of everything. It's about human relationships, which, of course, is precisely what the theory of everything actually addresses. And so I always say as a little joke, the headlines the next day, I went to the premiere with Stephen, and Stephen Hawking finds the theory of everything enjoyable. Because he did, but it hasn't actually found the theory of everything. And the theory of everything, when physicists talk about it, isn't a theory of everything. It's only a theory of half the things. Now, of course, if you into Buddhism, you know a crucial thing of Buddhism is mindfulness. And yet, what's the striking feature of this triumph of physics is its mindlessness. However, I would argue, and I know Alan would argue, is that mind is a fundamental and not an incidental feature of the universe. You see, the mainstream view tends to be that, okay, we might be conscious, but it's pure. We play a purely passive role in the universe. I don't believe that. I think that mind is fundamental. Now, what are the arguments for that? Well, there are a lot of arguments, and I don't have time to go through all of them. One of them is to do with the anthropic principle, the fact that there seem to be tunings in the universe required for us to be here. I've spoken on this on many occasions. I'm not going to talk about it now. The other is quantum theory, because quantum theory is the one point in physics where there is an indication that actually the observer plays a role. And I think Alan's going to talk more about this. And so some people say that's where mind is coming to come into physics. But it's controversial. Not all quantum physicists believe that, but some do. But the third factor is actually psi. I told you I was interested in psychic phenomena. One of the reasons I'm interested in psychic phenomena, because psychic phenomena involve a direct interaction between consciousness and the physical world. And therefore, it cannot be purely incidental to the physical world. If I focus on you and you start levitating, my mind is interacting with the physical world. And I would claim that if you believe psychic phenomena, that happens. I don't mean you levitating, but the phenomena in general. Well, why do people think there's a link with quantum theory in the mind? I'll only talk very briefly here. Wigner was the person who argued that in quantum mechanics, systems are described by wave functions. And the wave function collapses into a particular state to be observed. And the idea is that consciousness may be responsible for the collapse of the wave function. This is the idea of the universe which evolves consciousness, which then looks back and reflects on its origin, the Big Bang, just as we've been doing. And in some pictures of quantum theory, the consciousness actually is what brings the universe into existence. Henry Stapp has a more precise view of this, where he says consciousness not only collapses the wave function, but can control how it collapses, which is important if you want to explain psychic phenomena. David Bohm, many of you I'm sure have heard of, he talks about the implicate order which underlies the explicit order of the physical world. And so, this nice Escher picture. In other words, the observer is part of the situation he's trying to observe. You cannot separate the observer from the observed. I'm not going to say more about that, but it's, I think maybe Alan will. And it's because of this that so many quantum physicists have stressed that consciousness really is important, despite the mainstream view that consciousness can be swept under the carpet. So here are some quotes. I just about read these. Max Planck, I regard consciousness as fundamental. I regard matter as derivative from consciousness. We cannot get behind consciousness. Everything that we talk about, everything that we regard as existing, postulates consciousness. Planck was one of the founders of quantum theory. Here is Wigner, who I've just referred to. It is not possible to formulate the laws of physics in a fully consistent way without reference to the consciousness of the observer. Noam Chomsky, who is a linguist, physics must expand to explain mental experience. John Wheeler, who played a crucial role in this, and I know Anna will talk more about him, mind and universe are complementary. Bernard Espanier, the doctrine that the world is made up of objects whose existence is independent of human consciousness turns out to be in conflict with quantum mechanics and with facts established by experiments. And then Penrose, my position demands a major revolution in physics. There's something very fundamental missing from current science. Our understanding at this time is not adequate, and we're going to have to move to new regions of science. So not everybody says consciousness is important. A lot of influential people realize that consciousness is important. Psychical research. I keep talking about this, and some of my friends wonder why I'm so obsessed with psychical research. Let me just briefly say what psychical research deals with. That these are the phenomena. Telepathy, mind-to-mind communication, clairvoyance, seeing what's going on in another room without being there, precognition, seeing the future, psychokinesis, affecting objects with your mind, levitation, sorry, this is what you were going to do, levitating, poltergeist phenomena, where you have physical effects which are hard to control, apparitions, near-death experiences. Of course, we have Peter Fenwick in the room, one of the world's experts on that, and out-of-body experiences. All of these are examples of phenomena which are not explicable in the usual paradigm. And yet, I would argue there is good evidence for all of these phenomena. They show, as I said before, some direct interaction between consciousness and the physical world. Now, how do you explain this? Well, some people have argued that quantum theory can explain it. They use what's called entanglement. Now, this is rather too technical, but the idea of entanglement is that you could have two particles, for example, which go off in different directions, and then when this particle behaves in a certain way, this particle has to behave in the same way, in a related way. And that might not seem very dramatic, but it really is, because it means there is a sort of acausal influence which cannot be explained in classical physics. It's what we call non-locality. In some sense, space is transcended. So we're talking about space and time and consciousness. In some sense, quantum mechanics transcends space. And again, many people have said that this is crucial to explaining psi. Minds are entangled with the universe, so in principle, minds can non-locally influence anything, including a collection of other minds or physical systems. So Dean Radin argues that entanglement is the crucial component of explaining these so-called psychic phenomena. Brain-to-brain connections. Using fMRI and EEG methodology, a dozen experiments demonstrate that distant brains of emotionally close individuals can simultaneously register a stimulus when only one is stimulated. That's the sort of phenomena you're dealing with, which can't be explained by normal physics. I'm not going to read all of these. It's taking too long. Let me go straight to broad. It may be that our deep interconnectedness with each other and with all of nature is the major conclusion that issues forth from the many findings of consciousness research. So what it's saying is that the existence of these phenomena shows that our minds are all connected. And the great advocate of this is Larry Dossey, who's written a recent book called One Mind. I'm sure some of you have heard of this. And I'll just give you, these quotes actually come from Larry Dossey, so here they are. Ralph Emerson, there is one mind common to all individual men, a universal mind. Schrodinger, to divide or multiply consciousness is something meaningless. There is obviously only one alternative, namely the unification of minds or consciousness. In truth, there is only one mind. And then Bohm, deep down, the consciousness of mankind is one. This is a virtual certainty, and if we don't see that, it's because we are blinding ourselves to it. So when we talk about consciousness, the question is, really, are our minds really separate, or are they part of something bigger? And I'm going to skip the next slide, but simply because I'm running a little bit out of time. Now, let's now go back to mainstream science. Mainstream science tends to have the view, first of all, that matter is the only reality. This is what's called materialism. Everything is explained by physics, by which we mean local interactions of bits of matter obeying the known laws of physics. That's what's called reductionism. Everything we experience, or everything can be reduced to basic physics, including consciousness. Consciousness is generated by the brain. This is epiphenomenalism. So basically, consciousness is just like an excretum of the neuronal activities. And then, of course, religion, spirituality, mystical insights, all of those are illusions, according to the mainstream view. So that, if you like, might be said to be atheism. Now, I keep referring to this as mainstream science, but it's not all scientists. But what I want to stress is that this isn't actually science. This is what is sometimes called scientism. It's a particular view of science, a sort of fundamentalist version of science, which is remarkably strong in the West. But that's precisely the sort of view, scientism, which is not going to be accepting the sort of phenomena we're interested in tonight. But I'm stressing that because I'm not going against science. I'm a scientist, and I want to argue that science can be expanded, and I know Alan has the same view, to incorporate consciousness in these sorts of phenomena. And this is sometimes called the promissory materialism, and actually, I'm not going to read all these quotes, partly because I find it rather hard to read them, and partly because I'm getting a little bit short of time. But basically, promissory materialism basically is the view that materialism will actually one day explain everything, even though we have no evidence that it actually will. Promissory materialism is a superstition without a rational foundation. It is simply a religious belief held by dogmatic materialists who confuse their religion with their science. It has all the features of messianic prophecy. Now, one of the key features of promissory materialism is that the mind is generated by the brain. So that's the question we've got to ask. Is the mind, is consciousness just an epiphenomena of the brain? And again, there are different views here. The people who say yes, here is Francis Crick. A person's mental activities are entirely due to the behavior of the nerve cells, glial cells, and the atoms, ions, and molecules that make up and influence them. Sir Francis Crick. Marvin Minsky, the brain is just a computer made of meat. He's actually died now, so he'll know whether that's really true. It's actually easier. And then the third quote, thinking is not the mind, is just the mind, is just the meat talking to itself. I'm not even going to read all of these quotations. I don't think you can actually read them very well there. But then on the other side, you have people who actually take a different view. Here is Steven Pinker, who says, how could consciousness arise from the physical brain? Beats the heck out of me. I have some prejudices, but no idea of how to begin to look for a defensible answer. But nor does anybody else. Here is Stuart Kaufman. Nobody has the faintest idea what consciousness is. I don't have any idea, nor does anybody else, including the philosophers of mind. And here is Freeman Dyson. The organ, the origin of it is a total mystery, and so is the evidence of human consciousness. We have no clear idea of how the electrical discharges occurring in nerve cells in our brain are connected with our feelings and So the point anyway is clear. I hope you can actually read these. You can read them better than I can on the screen. So that's the key question. And I'd like to actually emphasize a couple of books which are very important. There was the book Irreducible Mind, which was basically collecting together all those phenomena which basically go against this view that consciousness is just produced by the brain. That came out about nine years ago. And then so-called study of rogue phenomena. And then there was another book that came out, Beyond Physicalism, which was basically talking about the theories which you need to try and how you can go beyond this materialistic paradigm. And I actually contributed a chapter to that. So I think these two books are particularly important. And it's interesting how they came about. They came about because at Esalen, which some of you may have heard of, that they run a seminar for many years, and on this, particularly on these topics. And it was actually founded, this seminar series was founded by Michael Murphy, and it was actually funded by John Cleese. And basically, this is a statement out of the book. We think it requires astonishing hubris to dismiss en masse the collective wisdom and experience of a large proportion of our forebears, including persons widely recognized as pillars of all human civilization. And we believe that the single most important task confronting all of modernity is that of the meaningful reconciliation of science and religion. So in some sense, one is seeking a middle way between the polarized fundamentalisms of science and religion, an enlarged conception of nature anchored in science and including spiritual realities. So the point is, on the one hand, here you've got your religious fundamentalism, and on the other hand, you've got your scientific fundamentalism, what I'm calling the scientism. You somehow have got to get past both of those, and that's what they're trying to do. And we had recently we had the manifesto for a post-materialistic science. And again, I will read this out. The modern scientific worldview is predominantly predicated on assumptions of scientific materialism, that matter is the only reality. But conscious mental activity can be experienced in near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, and in profound spiritual experiences. 2014, a group of scientists from a variety of fields came together to challenge the materialistic worldview at an international summit on post-materialist science. This resulted in a summary report asserting that mind is fundamental in the universe and cannot be derived from matter or reduced to anything more basic. That minds are apparently unbounded and may unite in ways suggesting a unitary one mind that includes all individual minds. That the evidence suggests that survival of consciousness following bodily death, and that scientists should investigate spiritual experiences since they represent a central aspect of human existence. Now, I'm not saying I'm agreeing with everything in that, and I'm sure not all of us will agree with everything in that statement, but the crucial point is that you need a form of science that goes beyond materialism, at least if you take these phenomena seriously. And so that is the manifesto for postmaterialist science, if you want to go to the website. Now, I'm overshooting, by the way, so I think what I'm going to do, can I have 5 minutes? Okay. What I wanted to say was how science and religion can help each other, and I'll just give one example of how science helps religion. This is in the studies of evidence for reincarnation in young children. This is the work which was done by Ian Stevenson and his colleagues. And I think his work provides profound evidence, maybe not necessarily for reincarnation, but at least for the idea that our consciousness is not just generated by the brain, that something can pass on from one life to another life. And, of course, there's a huge literature. I can't go into that in great detail. He did his work primarily focusing on the memory of children, and got a nice little cartoon. The most convincing evidence is from children who recall and verify details of previous lives. And so there's a nice little cartoon there. I don't know if you can read it. Yeah, well, I didn't... The little boy is saying to his father, yeah, well, I didn't believe in reincarnation when I was your age either. I'm not going to go through the evidence of that. How does religion help science? Well, and this is particularly relevant to Buddhism, I would say there is, if you read the religious texts, there is evidence that they've in some sense anticipated scientific advances. And in the context of Buddhism, for example, there is evidence that Buddha claimed to get information about the world through clairvoyance. The idea is that you get information through the teaching, through the Dharma, also through intellectual processes, through rationality, but also he claimed that you could have information through clairvoyant knowledge of the universe. And I'm getting my information from a book called Facets of Buddhist Thought. But the claim is that his clairvoyant insights and those of his disciples actually were pertinent to the physical universe. The claim was he would have information about the physical universe, which is only today, 2,000 years later, being confirmed. Now, I don't have time to get into that, but I have been studying some of the Visuddhimagga texts, and I think there is good evidence in principle that he did have amazing prescience, if you like, about the nature of the universe and the time scale of the universe and things like that. And it's a strange concept because here we are obtaining all our information about the universe with the International Space Station at the cost of hundreds of billions of dollars. But here's the idea that in some sense you can go into a deep meditative state and obtain information about the physical universe, things like how old it is and its future, through, if you like, inner science. And I know you also, Alan, like the idea of the I think you call it the inner telescope or the mind's telescope. And it's a very interesting idea. Now, so that's how it helps. Now, I'm not going to continue my discussion, but one of the key points I was going to say, which I will just say in words, when we talk about space and time, we start off with, of course, the Newtonian picture of three dimensions of space and one dimension of time. Then physicists told us that we had to have our four-dimensional, the Einstein view of space-time. And that is what most of us think of as reality. But actually, nowadays, physicists, when they try and develop their final theory of physics, think the world has many more dimensions than the three dimensions of space and the one dimension of time. They argue that the world, it depends which theory you believe, but the argument is that M theory, the total number of dimensions is actually 11. So you have all these extra dimensions. And the sort of view that physicists actually give us, this is mainstream physics even, is that the physical world might just be a slice. It's what's called a brain, B-R-A-N-E. It's like a four-dimensional slice in a high-dimensional space called the bulk. And to me, the crucial question when you try and accommodate mind into physics is that you have to have some space in which to describe mental phenomena. And my main message, which I'm just going to say in one sentence, is that the way in which you can accommodate mind, mental, paranormal, and spiritual phenomena is that you need some form of higher dimensional space which goes beyond the space of ordinary physics. And that's how you're going to accommodate these phenomena. And furthermore, that higher dimensional space, in some sense, is related to the higher dimensional space of modern physics. Now, maybe that idea will come out, I hope it will come out in greater detail in the discussion. But in any case, I've overshot my time, Alan, I'm sorry about that, but thank you very much.